all sorts of things like that. So if you're interested in going to that, it's completely optional, but if you're interested in it, please email her by Thursday at 5 o'clock. That email address there. So just before I start, how many people have done some kind of cosmology course before? Or just give me a show of hands. Not so many people. Okay, great. So the outline of this course is going to be 4 lectures. And so the outline, the rough outline is today I'm going to give an overview of the basics of cosmology. And in the next lecture, I'm going to give sort of discussion of the history of the universe, and so that's going to involve sort of significant epochs in the history of the universe, such as nucleosynthesis and recombination, and related to that, will I'm going to discuss the important topic of the cosmic microwave background. And in the third lecture, I'm going to discuss about the growth of structure in the universe. And so what that means is, how do galaxies form? And the last lecture will be about inflation in the universe. Okay, now I've put some, I think you probably all picked them up, but I've put the problems for there's only going to be one problem set for the 2 weeks, and they were at the back, and they're not yet online, but they will be online soon. And I haven't figured out how you're going to hand them back, because obviously because I'm at the end, it could be that I will ask you to give them back on the last one of these courses, but that's on the fourth lecture. But I don't think that's very good for you, because you need some more time. So I'll have to figure that out. I'll tell you on Thursday how we're going to do that. Okay. So to start off with, what is cosmology? So cosmology is the study of the universe. So that's really trying, you know, studying everything we can possibly know, the entire universe, entire space and time at the largest scales. And so it's the study of its origin, its dynamics, and sometimes as well we study, it's a bit more speculative, but we also study the possible fate of the universe, what's going to happen after today. And so in practice, the cosmology is the study of the largest distance scales. So typically for a cosmologist, a galaxy is small. Often we treat galaxies as point particles. And what we're interested in is the understanding physics, the physics that goes on at even larger scales, at galactic scales. So the universe is full of many galaxies that form into various different types of structures, clusters of galaxies. And then there are also empty regions called voids. And understanding how those form is a crucial part of cosmology. And the current observable size of the universe and we'll get later on we'll get to understand why there's a sort of finite limit on how much we can see in the universe, but that size is a distance of about 4,000 megaparsecs. So does anybody know what a parsec is? Okay, a couple of people, good. What's a parsec? You used to know, that's good enough.
It's a parallax second, I believe.
think that's right. Yeah. So do you know roughly speaking what length that corresponds to a parsec?
I know it's 1 second. If you're viewing two stars away, it's 1 second of angle off the Earth.
But what?
I know that is a distance.
You know, okay.
So it, 2 or 3 light years.
Exactly. Yeah. So one parsec is about, I think it's 3.26 light years. Okay, so a light year is the distance traveled by light in 1 year. And if you work that out in meters, that's about 3 times 10 to the 16 meters. So that's, in meters, that's a massive number, but that's typically quite a small distance from perspective of a cosmologist. And we're typically interested in ranges from 1 parsec out to 4,000 megaparsecs, i.e. 4 gigaparsecs. This is the size of the observable universe today. And did I write down what distance that is? No. Okay. So when we look out in space and we look at galaxies and we look at stars, when we look out to farther distances, we're also looking out to earlier times. And that's because it takes a finite time for light for some galaxy out here. If we see that and we're out here, if that's some distance d away, then when we see that galaxy from a telescope down here, we're actually not seeing that galaxy as it is today, but we're seeing as it is in the past, because it takes a finite time for light to travel to us. So that time is given by the distance to the galaxy divided by the speed of light, which is about 3 times 10 to the 8 meters per second. So because cosmologists are interested in the very largest distances and what's going on there, we're also typically interested in the very earliest times, because we're looking back to earlier and earlier epochs in the history of the universe. And the basic reason why there's only a finite observable size of the universe in terms of distance is because the universe only has a finite age. And that age is about, what is it? It's about 13 billion years. So I'm sure everybody is familiar with the idea of the Big Bang, that the universe began by some explosion is not the right word, but it sort of does it reasonable justice about 13 billion years ago. So because the universe is finite age in time, there's only a finite distance that light could have traveled. And so as we're looking back out to farther distances, we're looking back out to farther time, then that's the reason why there's only a finite observable size of the universe. The argument's a little bit more subtle than that, but we're going to get to that later on. So now, cosmology is very closely connected with astrophysics as well. So astrophysics tends to be more concerned with distance scales of the galaxy and smaller, so what's going on more in the recent universe and at shorter distance scales. And the basic difference between the two areas is that in astrophysics, usually the fundamental physics, so the fundamental laws that describe what's going on, are well understood. So that's because mostly they involve laws that we understand today, like Newtonian gravity, like nuclear forces and electromagnetic forces. These are all things that are relatively well understood. But the dynamics is very complicated. So what makes astrophysics a difficult subject is that you're interested. So trying to understand a galaxy and how the stars form within a galaxy and all that is very complicated physics. We know the fundamental laws that describe it, but it's very difficult to do in practice. Now, cosmology is a sort of the exact mirror image, that the fundamental laws are not well understood at all. But ironically, the dynamics is typically quite simple. And in fact, for most of the, for a large part of the history of the universe, the equations that governs what goes on can be taken to be linear, and so are relatively simple to solve. And the fact that the fundamental laws of physics are not well understood for cosmology means that should follow my notes. Okay. So this gives strong connections into things that you've already heard about, such as string theory and quantum gravity. These play an important role, some of which I'll discuss later, and also particle physics. All these play an important role in cosmology. And typically, cosmology is a more speculative subject, because we don't understand the fundamental laws as well. That also, in many ways, makes it more interesting to understand how the universe was formed, what happened, the Big Bang. So typical questions cosmologists are interested in are things like, how do galaxies form, as I've said. What is dark matter? And so dark matter is something, an invisible sort of form of matter that fills most of the universe. In fact, it makes up about, currently I think it makes up about 26% of the total matter of the universe is known to be in some dark matter, matter that we can't see through electromagnetic radiation. What is dark energy? So dark energy is another form of energy that we're going to talk about a bit later, which makes up something like 76%. Okay, that's great. They don't add up, do they? Okay. So rough. Okay. About 24. So 76% of the universe. And questions like, why is there more matter? Than antimatter in the universe. That's something that people are studying, trying to understand. What caused inflation? That's something we'll get to in the last lecture, what inflation is. And that plays a role as one possible idea in the question of where do the density fluctuations that are responsible for galaxy formation. Come from, and that's something we'll talk about in the third lecture. So those are just an example of questions that cosmologists and people here are working on at the moment. Okay, so I can send. Okay, so if you think about it, it's kind of an amazing thing that you can actually describe the entire universe. Ah, there they are. Nobody there at all. Okay, great. It's an amazing thing that you can describe the universe as a whole. I mean, you think, you know, surely as you start thinking about more and more things, physics is going to get more and more complicated. How can we possibly, if we can't even understand the weather, we can't predict what the weather's going to be tomorrow, how can we possibly understand the universe? And the basic reason is because of something which is often called the cosmological principle, although I think this is a bad name, because it's really an observational fact, which was first introduced theoretically by Einstein, and I think in around 1917. And this is the fact that, to a very good approximation, the universe is isotropic. Isotropic and homogeneous, or a homogeneous, however you say it. And what does that mean? So the statement that the universe is isotropic approximately means that if we look out in any direction in the sky and we sort of count, we see how many galaxies, how bright it is out there, we sort of average over that. We look out in some direction over here, but on average it looks the same. Okay, so it won't be identically the same, of course, because you'll be looking at different galaxies. But on average, I did write it. So the universe looks the same. In every direction. And that's called isotropy. And this is it's important to stress this is an observational fact that we know to be true. And although Einstein introduced it as a sort of fundamental principle, he really introduced it to when he general relativity was first invented around 1915, he wanted to understand what the implications of general relativity were for the universe. And so he introduced this principle actually just to make the equation simpler so he could see what was going on. And it wasn't really realized until much later that it was actually a very good approximation to the truth, that the universe really was, to a very good approximation, isotropic and homogeneous. And it's not something you'd actually expect. In fact, the universe is more isotropic than we expect it to be. And that creates something known as the horizon problem, which we'll get to later, and that's important in the story of inflation as one possible solution to explaining why the universe is isotropic as it is. Homogeneity is the statement that there is no... The universe looks the same... from every point in space. So we could also say that's the same as saying there is no preferred point in space. So what that means in practice, let's draw a little picture. Here's us on the Earth. And we look out, there's various galaxies and stars. And so how we test that the universe is isotropic is as we look out in some direction, and we count along the line of sight how many galaxies we see of a given brightness, okay, in some particular direction. And then we do that in all the different directions. So we look around, as you have to use different telescopes in practice to get the northern part of the sky and the southern part of the sky, you look in every different direction, you count how many galaxies you see of a given luminosity in a given direction. And what you find is that, on average, there are as many galaxies of a given luminosity in this direction as there are in that direction. That's the statement of isotropy. Homogeneity, on the other hand, is the statement that if you went to, say, Alpha Centauri over here, and you did the same experiment, so you built telescopes there, and you looked out in every direction, the universe not only would look isotropic from that point, but you'd also see, on average, the same number of galaxies in a given direction as you do here on Earth. So that's the statement. The Earth is not a special point. It doesn't matter where you go in the universe, it'll look pretty much the same.
The edge. There is no edge. There's no edge.
There's no further point closer to it.
No, because, so that's one of the things about general relativity. It doesn't matter how... So we personally have sort of an edge, which is our horizon that we're going to get to later. So we on the Earth... that's a bad picture. But so we have a horizon, which is this distance scale of about 4,000 megaparsecs. Okay, so that's our sort of edge. But someone here over here has a different horizon. So he sees the universe exactly the same as us. And his edge, as it were, is different. So in practice, there is no edge of the universe. Everywhere looks exactly the same. No, we're saying, so every observer will have a different observable universe, but his own observable universe will look the same as ours. That's the statement of homogeneity.
That doesn't contradict the finiteness of the universe?
The universe is not spatially finite, it's spatially infinite. Okay, it's only what we can see is finite. So the universe is spatially infinite, but we can only see a finite region. But someone else can see a finite region, but he sees a different finite region. Okay. Now, of course, in practice, you can't do this. So isotropy is very easy to check from an observational point of view. But homogeneity is much more difficult. And so we have to use different methods to test if the universe is really homogeneous, because we can't go to Andromeda and check to see if it looks the same from there. And so the way we do that, there are different ways of characterizing that, but one way is through looking at the mass fluctuations, or equivalently the density fluctuations, just the same thing written differently in the universe. And so what do I mean by that? So if the universe was really isotropic and homogeneous, it would mean that you could think that there was some, you could describe all the galaxies and stuff by some mass density or energy density, which is the same thing, by equals mc squared. So some mass density which was independent of space. So just a constant. It might depend on time, but it's independent of space. Okay? So the universe is just filled with constant density. And we know that's not really true, of course, because you know, a star is got a much larger density than the space between the sun and the earth. But on average, homogeneity, both of these statements are really statements on average. So if you blur out galaxies and average over them, homogeneity is the statement that there'll be some constant density that describes that situation. So if the universe was really perfectly homogeneous, you would have a completely constant density of matter in the universe which was independent of space. And that would mean if you draw any sphere of some given radius and you calculate, so that's full of galaxies and stars, and you calculate how much mass is in that sphere, then let's suppose that constant density, the average density is rho bar, the average mass in that sphere will just be the density times 4/3 pi r cubed. Okay? And so if the universe was really homogeneous, it doesn't matter where you would place that sphere, it could be a sphere around the Earth, or it could be a sphere around Andromeda, if it was the same radius, you would find the same total mass within that. Now, that isn't true, of course, because clearly the universe isn't exactly homogeneous. And so when you do that in practice, you get fluctuations. Depending on where you draw your sphere and calculate the total mass within that sphere, you'll get a different answer. So the way we do this in practice, again, you know, we're always limited by the fact that we can only observe things from Earth. But so what we do is we look out in the sky and we find various galaxies out there. And we work out the distance to those galaxies. And we work out the mass of the galaxies. So I'll get in a little bit to how we do that. But just let's say for a moment that we know for galaxies that we can observe, we know the mass, and we know the distance to that galaxy. And so we calculate within some sphere of radius r how much mass is contained in that. And depending on where we draw that sphere, as we look around us, we'll get different answers. So the mass, which in general is the density times 4/3 pi r cubed, will be something that fluctuates. And what we can do is calculate the mean, and we can calculate the standard deviation. So the variance would be the average of the mass minus the mean square, just standard calculation of variance, the standard deviation would be the square root of that. Okay, everyone happy with that? And in general, the way we parameterize this is by the fractional deviation. So that's the standard deviation divided by the mean. And so we can do that for spheres of different radius. So we're calculating on average how much mass is in different spheres of the same radius. That's the important thing. And in practice, when we do this, what this deviation is will depend on the radius that we take. So the bigger the radius we take, the more we're averaging things out, and the more homogeneous we expect things to be. And the actual numbers are, if you take R to be about 60 megaparsecs, then this fractional deviation, the fractional fluctuation of the mass from the mean in proportion to the mean, is about 0.1. So another way of saying that is that the universe appears homogeneous to about 10% if we average over scales which are about 60 megaparsecs in size. If we go out to larger radius, then naively we expect things to be more and more homogeneous because we're averaging, and that's true. And the way it scales is as an inverse square law. So it scales like that. So that means that if we go out, say, to 10 times R naught, so that's 600 megaparsecs, which is already about a tenth of the size of the observable universe, then sigma will decrease by a factor of 10 squared, so it'll decrease by 100. So it'll be about 10 to the minus 4. Okay. So by averaging over some length scale, the larger we make that length scale, the more homogeneous the universe looks. But crucially, this number is already small at 600 megaparsecs, well before we've hit the size of the observable universe. And so to a good approximation, we can say that the universe is homogeneous because of that. Now, as is often the case, you know, most of what we're really interested in current research is understanding those departures from homogeneity, because they contain all the interesting information on the physics of the early universe. And so understanding that is what I'm going to get to in the third and fourth lectures. Okay, so what do we know? We know that the universe is, to a good approximation, isotropic and homogeneous. So Einstein guessed these facts just to simplify his equation, but they turned out to be true. And then we also know something else. The universe is expanding. And we know this because of a guy named Edwin Hubble, who the Hubble Space Telescope was named after, who in the 1920s and 30s did some very, very hard work, what was very hard work at the time, to try to figure out what the typical velocities of galaxies were and get some understanding of that. And he found a remarkable relation. So he looked out at galaxies and he figured out his velocity, their velocities, and he found that the velocity of galaxies, on average, turned out to be proportional to their distance away from us, and always in the sign, so that the velocity was moving away from us. So that if here we are on the Earth and some galaxy out here, On average, you found that the velocities of galaxies were moving away from us along the line of sight that you were looking at. So by that, I mean that the direction of the velocity was away from the Earth. Now, that's never precisely true, because galaxies have what we call peculiar velocities. And so this statement, again, this statement is only true on average. Sometimes you found the galaxies would be coming towards us or going in a slightly different direction. But if you plot, on average, the velocity of a galaxy as a function of its distance away from us, then there'll be scatter around some constant line. That's what Hubble found. And the value of this constant that he found, so this constant has dimensions 1 over time, because it's a velocity, meters per second, divided by a distance, meters. So it's got dimensions of inverse time. And the value he came up with for this constant was about 550 kilometers per second per megaparsec. So that means if a galaxy is 1 megaparsec away from us, then its velocity away, on average, would be 550 kilometers per second. Now, it turns out that, so Hubble was working in early days with not such great measures of distance. And current the value of this parameter changed for many years. Yep.
Kind of go against homogeneity, because if everything's moving away from the Earth kind of spherically, if you went to another point, wouldn't it look a little different?
We're going to get to that.
Yeah, the answer is no. It's completely consistent with homogeneity. Some people are turning up.
They can't get in.
Oh, is that the problem?
It's Evan.
It's Scott.
It wouldn't box if you want to see it.
Okay, so the current value of this parameter is about, so it's normally written like this, as 100 times some small parameter h kilometers per second per megaparsec. So this is just a way of parameterizing what this quantity is. And so what you actually care about is what is the value of this small parameter h. And I think currently this is about 0.7 within an accuracy of about 0.07. So depending on your preference, it could be 0.6, 0.7. But it's around that value. So how did he measure the velocities of galaxies? So the way he figured out the velocity of the galaxies away from us was using the Doppler effect. So I assume everyone's familiar with the Doppler effect, right? Okay. So you're familiar with the idea of depending on if something is moving away from you and emits, or moving towards you and it emits some radiation. Or a wave, it could be sound waves, any kind of wave of a given wavelength, then the wavelength you see, so that object, which here is a galaxy, is moving away from you with some velocity v, then the wavelength that you observe is different from the wavelength which is emitted, given by v divided by the speed of light, in the case of light, the speed of sound. In the case of sound, the speed of sound. So that's the Doppler effect. So in cosmology, we define something called redshift, which is just another way of parameterizing this effect. The redshift z or z, which is the change in wavelength, the observed wavelength, minus the emitted wavelength divided by the emitted wavelength. Okay. So this formula is only true for velocities much less than the speed of sound because of relativistic effects. But at the time, that was good enough. He wasn't working with relativity at the time. And so this redshift is basically just equal to V over C. So it's another way of parameterizing. And it's called the redshift because literally, if something is moving away from us, then the observed wavelength, so that if something is moving away from us, which is V greater than zero in the way I've done it, then the redshift is positive. And that means that the observed wavelength is bigger than the emitted wavelength. And that's called the redshifting because in the visible spectrum, red is at longer wavelengths. And blue is at shorter wavelengths. Okay. And we use that term redshifting, even though it may have nothing to do with visible wavelengths. It's just stuck. And so what Hubble found is that when he looked at galaxies, he could analyze the spectrum of those galaxies, spectrum of light from the galaxies, and the spectrum of the light from a star or a galaxy will have characteristic telltale signatures such as emission and absorption lines. Absorption lines, which have to do with the chemical composition of the star that's emitting the light. And so in particular, hydrogen has some specific spectral characteristic signature that you can measure in the lab, and you can calculate exactly at what wavelength that should be. And so in atomic, is everyone familiar with the idea of spectral lines and that kind of thing? Okay, so you know this stuff. So the point is, in the lab, you can measure what particular wavelengths correspond to a given chemical. And so you can infer what a star is made of by the lines that you see, because it'll be made by specific atoms, specific chemical content. But what he actually observed, of course, was that if you look at a galaxy and analyze the spectrum, you get exactly these lines, but typically shifted in wavelength. So that's the red shifting. So wavelength is increasing that way. And so by figuring out, just by this formula, how much the wavelengths were lengthened or shortened, you can figure out the redshift, and then in turn figure out the velocity of the galaxy. Now, to get that relationship, you also needed to know the distances to galaxies. Now, calculating, observing the distance to galaxies is a much more complicated thing to do, and is actually the main reason for the fact that he got an answer which was like five times larger than what we believe today. And distances are always the sort of thorny part in astrophysics and cosmology, because we have to make some, you know, we can't actually measure the distance to a galaxy directly, so we do it by something called a distance ladder. So what that means is, so one method we can measure distances by that works very well is something called parallax. And this works very well for stars that are very close to us. And that's simply the fact, okay, if we draw the sun here and the Earth there, so the Earth goes around the sun in some kind of elliptical orbit. And we know this distance pretty well. We can measure it by radar ranging the distance of the Earth around, the orbit of the Earth around the Sun as a function of time is known very well. Okay? And let's suppose we've got some star out here, then, and some other star over here, well, let me draw it here, which is much farther away. And I'm going to call that the fixed stars, because the farther away it is, the less we see stars moving. And the method of parallax is simply the fact that when we're over here relative to the Sun, we see this star make some angle with some fixed star out here. So when we look out in the sky, we just see, let's call this A and B. We see B here and then A just to the left of it. But as the Earth moves around the Sun, that angle changes. And so when we're out here, A is up there and B is out there. So the angle, clearly from this picture, the angle between A and B is much greater. And so in practice, that will look like, so as we plot through the orbit, through one year, through the orbit of the Earth around the Sun, this star, which is very far away, will typically remain in the same position, but A will move to be farther away. So that angle between these two that we see out in the sky changes. And because we know the distance between the Earth and the Sun, and the angle, the change in the angle, it's just a simple bit of trigonometry to figure out what this distance is between A and the Earth. Okay. And so this only works in practice for close distances. And a small distance here is about 50 parsecs, so 50, approximately about 80 light years or something like that. But beyond that, everything is so far away that its angle just doesn't change. You know, it just looks fixed. So we can't use the method of parallax. So the way we do that, there are two ways actually, but I'll just discuss one, is using something called the luminosity distance. And so that's basically figuring out the distance a star is away from us by how bright it is. And that's because if something is farther away, the farther away it gets, the less bright it'll be. And the brightness that we observe, which is the luminosity, so you can define it, say, as the amount of energy received in light per unit time, per unit area, that will scale by an inverse square law. Let me write D. So if something is twice as far away from us, then it'll be a quarter less luminous. So we can invert this relation to get the distance that something is away from us, given the luminosity. Okay, so that's just L naught, the 4 pi L, square rooted. So if we know, if we have some star, we know what this quantity is L0, which is the total energy emitted per unit time of that star, and we observe it with luminosity L, we calculate its distance. Now the problem in this formula is that for most things we don't know what L0 is. We don't really know how much energy is being emitted per unit time. But there are certain objects which are called standard candles. Which don't vary significantly in their properties, so that they always have the same luminosity L0. And so one example of those are something called Cepheid variable stars. And so they're stars the actual luminosity varies with time of a given frequency, and that's because the star itself is pulsing, it's expanding and contracting, and as it expands and contracts, it emits different amounts of light. And so we see some sort of characteristic. This is why it's called variable, just because the luminosity as a function of time is varying. And this limit, this will have some given time period, T0. And it turns, so for Cepheid variable stars that are very close by within distances of less than 50 parsecs, we can calculate their distance. And so we can infer for those stars what their actual fundamental luminosity L0 is. Okay, because for those, for the close by ones, we can get the distance. And so for those ones, we find, so I should have written L0 here. We find that for a given period T0, the luminosity L0 is essentially always the same. Okay? And that's why they're standard candles. So it means that we know if we're looking at the Cepheid variable, which is pulsing at a given rate, then we know what total energy is being emitted per unit time. So now if we look out to distances which are greater than 50 parsecs, how do we get the distance to the galaxy? It's just by if we find a Cepheid variable star within that galaxy, okay, and we see what we calculate the luminosity of that given star, which is this quantity here, we know what this quantity is by comparing with the nearby stars, and so we can infer its distance. And there are other examples of standard candles. So it turns out that the very brightest of galaxies also tend to have very common features, so the same values of L0. And also things called type 1A supernovae, which are a hot topic at the moment, are also very good standard candles. They tend to always have the same luminosity. And so that's how we can figure out distances. But of course, it's an imperfect science because L0 is always, it's never exactly the same value. And so it's only by averaging over large numbers of measurements that we can hope to cancel out those effects. And so in Hubble's time, the reason he got such a bad value of the Hubble constant, which was so much larger, is because of that. But nevertheless, he was able to see sufficiently well that on average, galaxies are moving away from us. Oh, so that's just supposed to say brightest galaxies.
Oh.
So in general, the luminosity of galaxies varies a lot, but there's a sort of maximum. So the very brightest ones always have the same luminosity. And that's type 1A supernovae. OK. Now,
is there any concern about a sort of systematic error in that if you look further away, you're looking earlier, so the chemical composition of everything is different, and the dynamics of these oscillating stars might be different?
That would certainly be an issue. Like, so you could imagine in certain sort of more speculative theories, like the electric charge could be a function of time. And so in a theory in which the electric charge is a function of time, the spacing of lines, which is determined by atomic physics, which is a function of the electric charge E, or more generally, we normally write it as defined structure constant, something like that, I don't know what it is. That could be a function of time. And so that would have to be taken into account.
I was thinking of something even more banal, and that the earlier stars would just have more hydrogen and less heavier elements.
So that's okay because you know exactly you can exactly pick out what is the hydrogen line, you know.
Would that affect the luminosity? What does that variable say? Like the dynamics of the star.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, so that's certainly an issue, yeah. And people worry about that kind of thing. And so even with the supernova, it's known that, you know, even amongst the type 1A supernova, people are now thinking maybe there's two types and some of them are different than the others. And it's all very complicated, so that's why it's never a perfect thing. But you know, you hope if you average over many, many measurements that those kind of systematics will cancel out. Now, okay, so Hubble's law is completely consistent with isotropy and homogeneity. Okay, so So Hubble's law, let's just restate it, is the statement that the velocity, on average, the velocity of galaxies will be away from us and proportional to the distance away from us. And this relationship, thinking of it as a vector relationship, is clearly consistent with isotropy. Because if we look out in any one direction, then we see that that galaxy will be moving away from us along the line of sight at a velocity which is determined by its distance away. And if we look out in this direction, and we find that there's a galaxy which is the same distance away, then its velocity will also be the same away from us along the line of sight. So every direction looks exactly the same. And Hubble's law is also Hubble's law is also consistent with homogeneity. And to see that, let's draw a triangle of three galaxies. Okay. So let's suppose we're here, galaxy A, there's a galaxy B, a galaxy C over here. So the distance between A and B is some vector dBA, and this distance is some vector dCB, and this distance is some vector dCA. Then Hubble's law is the statement that relative to us over here on A, the velocity of the galaxy B relative to us, well, let me just write it as the velocity of B, must be Hubble's constant times that distance of B relative to us, or the vector distance. And similarly, the velocity of the galaxy C away from us is equal to H times D CA. Okay? But if these velocities are much less than the speed of light, then we can also just figure out very simply what the velocity of C is relative to B. Just by basic vector rules, the velocity of C relative to B must be the velocity of C relative to B must be the velocity of C minus the velocity of B. So that's just the sort of basic rule of velocity addition, which is true as long as those velocities are much less than the speed of light. And so just plugging in these relationships, that means that this is equal to the vector distance BA minus the vector distance CA. And then also because these make up a triangle, that's equal to H times the distance between B and C. So what that means physically is if you were an observer in the galaxy B, then you looked at galaxy C and calculated its velocity, you would find that it was equal to the same constant that we see times the distance between C and B. And similarly, if you were in galaxy C and you calculated the velocity of A relative to you, then you would get some similar relationship. So homogeneity is true here because it doesn't matter which galaxy you are, at what point in space you are, you see every other galaxy moving away from you with a velocity proportional to its distance away from you, okay? So a crucial consequence of that is that there's no center of the expansion. So a lot of people have the idea when we say that the universe is expanding, it's expanding away from some special point and everything's moving away from that. But in fact, wherever you were in the universe, you will see the universe expanding around you as well. I wrote it down earlier. So it was when I wrote it. So the value of H today, we normally write it as 100 little h kilometers per second. So megaparsec, and this quantity is about 0.7. So I wrote that down earlier. So although H is naturally has units of inverse time. It's normal to write it still as the velocity divided by the distance using different units, because this is more practical from an observation point of view. Now, does this mean in this room right now are we expanding? Put your hand up if you think that the size of the room now is expanding because of this. Nobody wants to put their hand up. No. Okay, you're off. So the expansion of the universe, it's a little subtle, so it only really takes effect at large distances. But at short, at small distances, and that means us, then other forces take over, such as electromagnetism, which is what, you know, electromagnetism, the other forces of nature, and the weak forces and the strong forces. And these all have characteristic scales, characteristic length scales, which determine the size of atoms and the size of objects like us, okay? And these forces are much, much stronger locally than gravity. And so in this room right now, we're not expanding because those other forces are completely dominating it, and they determine the size of objects, the distance between atoms.
On a frictionless table and sat them down there, would the space between them be increasing?
No. Okay, but this is a little subtle. So you have to go out to some distance scale before you start seeing the effect of the expansion. Your example is good because the way the expansion works is exactly that between two galaxies, it's really the space between those galaxies that is expanding. But the galaxies themselves, not so much, because the size of those is governed by other physics.
But isn't the space between the two pucks expanding?
And
if there's no other force holding them together,
well,
they're just friction.
Well, the table's not expanding, is it?
So yeah, it's a frictionless table, so the...
Okay, maybe, yeah.
Sorry.
No, that's a sort of good example, yeah, exactly. You only really feel this expansion when gravity takes over, which is only at larger distance scales, and that dominates over the other forces. So it's not that everything is just expanding. Okay, so half an hour left. Good. Let's start up here. So another way of writing Hubble's law the velocity is proportional to the distance. And velocity, of course, is just the rate of change of distance. So that's just some vector equation. Rate of change of distance is equal to h times the distance. And it's simple to find a solution of this by making the ansatz that the distance is some function of time times some constant vector x. And substituting that in here, then we get the ADT x is equal h times ax. And the point is that this constant vector can just be cancelled out of this equation, so that what looks like a vector equation is really just a single scalar equation for this quantity A, which is called the scale factor. So this defines the quantity H as the rate of change of A divided by A, or alternatively as the rate of change of log A. Now A is known as the scale factor because it represents the sort of overall scaling of the distance between two galaxies. And this quantity, let me write it out explicitly. So D is A of T X. This is called the scale factor. And this is called the co-moving position whatever you're looking at. So this function, a function of time, which satisfies the relationship h is d log a dt, this factors out the overall expansion of the universe. And so two galaxies can be, instead of saying that two galaxies are, so the distance between two galaxies d is increasing with time, we can also work in the co-moving coordinates where we say that they're a fixed position x. So so if we take two things, the quantity x is constant, and so taking out the a of t in front factors out the overall expansion of the space between those two galaxies. And so although Hubble called this thing, well, I'm not sure he called it that, but this was known for a long time as Hubble's constant. But in fact, we know it's not constant. In general, it's also some function of time, okay, which is related to the scale factor in that way. If the Hubble constant was really a constant, then you could solve this relationship and find that a of t would increase exponentially. But more generally, you find only some, say, power law or some entirely different behavior. So the Hubble constant is really not a constant, although it's often still called that. It's something that's a function of the time you're looking at, so a function of the age of the universe. And the right framework for understanding all this is general relativity. Although, in fact, many of these things can be understood in the context of Newtonian gravity. So I gather you had some introduction lectures to general relativity. So in general relativity, the distance between two points which are close by is measured by something called the metric. So that distance ds, you take two very close by points which are described by some coordinates x mu and x mu plus dx mu, but distance is given by this, where this quantity is the metric and could be a function of space. So for a flat space-time, what is known as Minkowski space-time, then this quantity, the line element, is given by minus dt squared plus dx1 squared plus dx2 squared plus dx3 squared. So this is the statement: we live in four dimensions. Three of those are space and one is time, and so time comes in with the opposite sign here. So this metric describes flat space with nothing in it, no matter at all. But it's very easy to see from this relationship how to describe a space which is expanding, because what this is telling us is that we know from Hubble's law that the distance between two galaxies is increasing as a of t times some constant co-moving position. And this thing is the distance, albeit between two neighboring points. But if we can think of two galaxies as being infinitesimally close together, then the way we would describe that situation is by a metric that looks like this. Okay. And this metric is known as the FRW, sometimes FRWL, Friedman, Robertson, Walker, and Lemaître, after the people that came up with it. And this is the metric, strictly speaking, this is the metric for a spatially flat universe. And so for those of you that have studied a bit of GI, you probably know that this doesn't have to be flat, but it could also be described the metric of a three-sphere or a hyperbolic space. And I'm not going to discuss that, because we know that, you know, observationally, to a good approximation, the universe is actually spatially flat. So on a daily basis, we actually use this. So that describes the space-time in general relativity of an expanding space. And so I think it's pretty easy to see that Hubble's law directly comes out from that metric. The distance between two points when in general increases as the scale factor times some constant quantity, which is the co-moving position. And as some of you haven't done so much general relativity, I won't go into too much detail about how we describe the expansion of space in general relativity. But basically, it comes down. So general relativity basically tells you, let me summarize by the following statement, that the curvature of space-time is directly proportional to the stress energy density, or matter density, if you want to think of it like that, in the universe. Wherever we have mass or energy, that locally curves the space-time. And Einstein's equation is the statement that the curvature, which is described by G mu nu, is proportional to the stress energy T mu nu. In the case of an expanding universe described by this Friedman, Robertson, Walker metric, the curvature of space-time, so curvature has dimensions 1 over distance or time squared, if we work in units where the speed of light is 1. And the curvature of that metric turns out to basically be proportional, or at least one component of it, to the square of the Hubble constant. So the Hubble constant has dimensions of inverse time, so that's got dimensions of inverse time squared, or inverse distance squared. And so Einstein's equation tells you that that quantity, the curvature, must be proportional to the energy density rho in the universe, or the mass density, if you use units where the speed of light is 1, the two are the same thing. And that's called the Friedman equation. And that basically describes how the universe expands. Okay, so it tells us we can calculate what the Hubble constant is at a given time if we know what the density, the average density of the universe is. And so this is really that quantity rho bar that we talked about before, because the density actually changes locally. But when we're using this equation, we're using the average constant density if we smooth over all the galaxies and we think of it as some homogeneous distribution. More generally, there is, when we think about if the space is not spatially flat, like I've written it there, there's another term that goes like that, where k has the value minus 1, 0, or plus 1. But I'm just going to think about cases where k equals 0 for simplicity. And as I said, also we know observationally that the universe is, to good approximation, spatially flat. Although it's important to know what would happen if it wasn't, so that we can figure out that is true. So if we know the energy density of the universe as a function of time, we can figure out h, which is the rate of expansion of the universe. So it's the rate of expansion because h is the rate of change of the scale factor in units of the scale factor. But we can't solve this system unless we also know how the density of the universe changes with time. And to do that, we use the conservation of energy. So for those of you familiar with GR, this is the statement that the stress energy is conserved like that. But in the context of cosmology, it can be written in the following simple way, that the rate of change, if we take some fixed co-moving volume, so what do I mean by co-moving volume? So we take take a region of space, some cube of space, defined by its co-moving coordinates x, not by its physical coordinates. So that region of space is expanding, but remains fixed volume in co-moving coordinates. So the physical volume will go like a cubed times the volume in co-moving coordinates, which we assume to be fixed. So the total mass in that volume will be the energy density times the physical volume, a cubed times v co-moving. And if the fluid that describes the energy density of the universe has no pressure, then mass will be conserved. In other words, if there's no flux outside going in or out of that volume, then mass will be conserved. So this quantity will be zero. And so this is true. So this equivalently, we can just factor out V co-moving, the co-moving volume, out of this equation. So we can just rewrite it equivalently as the rate of change of rho A cubed is zero, which is the same as saying that the energy density will scale like 1 over A cubed. And so this will be true whenever the pressure of the fluid is zero. And we call, and basically that is true of matter, of massive particles, as opposed to radiation. More generally, if a fluid has pressure, then the mass within that volume is not conserved, and the relationship is that the change in the mass within the co-moving volume is equal to minus 3 times the pressure times the co-moving volume. And the 3 here comes from the fact that there are 3 spatial directions in which the pressure is acting. And so again, we can just factor out this co-moving volume out of this equation, and we can rewrite this equation in its more familiar form with a little rearrangement. There. So the rate of change of the energy density is equal to minus 3 times the Hubble constant, V plus rho. So the Hubble constant here enters because it determines the rate of change of the scale factor with time. So the rate of change of energy density is proportional to the rate of change of the scale factor, and therefore is proportional to the Hubble constant. And so that's the general relationship that d mu, t mu is zero. In other words, the local statement of conservation of energy. That's what it looks like in an expanding universe. Okay. So we can solve that equation, but even now, to solve this equation, we can't figure out how the density changes with time until we know what the pressure is. The pressure is a function of time. And so we have to make some statement about what kind of fluid are we looking at, or what kind of energy density are we looking at. And depending on what the energy density is, there'll be a different relationship for what the pressure is as a function of the energy density. Okay? And for fluids that we call perfect fluids, then the pressure is in general proportional to the energy density, and the proportionality constant W is, you know, is the same as P over rho. So W is, for a perfect fluid, W is a constant. So a particular, a trivial case is the case we just did, that if the fluid has no pressure, so it behaves like matter, then W equals zero. And other cases are, say, for radiation or for massless particles, So if for any particles which travel very close to the speed of light, you can essentially neglect their mass and think that they are traveling at the speed of light. And so they behave like photons. They behave like electromagnetic radiation. And it's a basic fact that for radiation, the pressure is 1/3 of the energy density. So photons, electromagnetic radiation, are a perfect fluid with W equals 1/3. So we can, in general, solve this conservation of energy equation. Let me just rewrite it at the top. So we wrote it as d rho dt is minus 3h d plus rho. So by substituting in this relationship for what the pressure is in terms of the density, we can write this as minus 3h rho times 1 plus w. And so if we know w, then we know how the density changes with time as a function of the density and the Hubble constant. And then the Freeman equation tells us what the Hubble constant is as a function of density. So we have two equations, essentially, for two unknowns, the density and the Hubble constant, or equivalently, the density and the scale factor. Because as soon as we know the Hubble constant is a function of time, we know what the scale factor is. So these two equations are the basic equations describing a homogeneous universe. And in this, we can rewrite that. We can solve this one very simply by rewriting it as follows. So using the fact that H is dA dt, d log A dt, then we can use the chain rule, or whatever it's called, to rewrite this equation as the rate of change of the energy density with log A is the same as dt d log A times d rho dt. So that's the same as 1 over h times d rho dt, which is minus 3 rho 1 plus w. And so that we can also rewrite that. We can rewrite that as the rate of change of the log of rho with log A is minus 3, 1 plus W, whose general solution is rho is some constant, A naught over A of T to the power of 3, 1 plus W, which often we'll just write as rho goes as A to the minus 3, 1 plus W. So for a given fluid, a given type of matter, we know what W is. So for matter, W is 0. For radiation, W is 1/3. And so we know how the energy density changes with the scale factor, which is indirectly telling us how the energy density changes with time. And then we can plug that into the Freeman equation. So H squared is 8 pi g over 3 rho, which is some constant rho naught A naught to the 3, 1 plus W divided by A to the 3, 1 plus W. And so writing this explicitly as some equation for the rate of change of the scale factor, so H is 1 over A dA dt, that's equal to the square root of 8 pi g over 3 rho naught A naught to the 3, 1 plus W over A to the 3, 1 plus W. So schematically, that's saying that the rate of change of the scale factor goes like some constant, let me just call that B, times A. We bring the A over this side, so we get A to the 1 minus 3, 1 plus W over 2. And this equation you can solve. It's now just a first order differential equation. We made a choice of sign when we took the square root of this, assuming that the universe was expanding, which it is, so that's okay. And we can just solve that. Let's see, can I do it on the spot? So in general, the solution of that is A the 3, 1 plus W over 2 goes like T. So A goes like T to the 2 over 3, 1 plus W. Okay. So for perfect fluid, W is a constant. The scale factor just behaves like a power law in time. And so for matter or dust, which is anything where the pressure is essentially zero, then W equals zero. And so we get the scale factor goes as T to the 2/3. For electromagnetic radiation or massless particles like neutrinos or something that's almost massless, something that's relativistic, then the pressure is a third of the energy density. So W is approximately third. And so then the scale factor goes like T to the half, and so on. And you can work this out for whatever type of fluid you're interested in. Okay, so I think I'll end there for now, and then we can carry on Thursday. Okay, thanks.